This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists and pundits suggest we need World War II-style mobilization to fight climate change. But what will it really take if we had the will to save ourselves from devastating climate change? What could we do? That's the task of a new book from Dr. Lawrence L. Delina. He's a postdoctoral associate at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. That's at Boston University. Lawrence is also the Rachel Carson Fellow at LMU University in Germany. From Munich, Lawrence Delina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Pleasure to be in your radio show.
Well, yes, we're going to talk about your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. And there is a question mark at the end of that title. Why?
That's actually intentional. I am offering the book as a critical take of the lessons and strategies for wartime mobilization as a possible policy model for rapid climate mitigation. That is, whether those moments in history can actually provide us lenses by which we, as contemporary human beings, can address the biggest challenge of our time, climate change. And the question mark at the end of the book subtitle signals that that particular critical take.
And the book comes with a foreword by one of my climate heroes, Dr. Hans Schellenhuber. And early on, he dared to ask the question, what if we go beyond 4 degrees C of heating? There were two conferences on that. Lawrence, do you know John Schellenhuber, and what does his foreword offer us?
I haven't personally met John yet, but I hope to make his acquaintance while I'm in Germany. John wrote the foreword to my book a few days after the Paris Agreement came out in December of 2015, and about 6 months after the release of Pope Francis' encyclical Laudato Si, which John presented in Vatican that June that year. In his foreword to my book, John talks about the main actors in what he calls a 3D drama of saving the world. First of these is disasters that teach people around the world that climate change is no joke and no fun. Second is discovery or innovation enabling leap forwards in technologies. And third is dignity or the morality of preserving the livelihoods of our brothers and sisters, which is basically the thrust of the Pope's encyclical.
That sounds pretty interesting to me, but strange as it sounds, I'm going to skip your first chapter on the awful things that will happen if we continue with fossil power. We'll probably get to that at some point. But you do tackle next the gritty question of whether we can find enough renewable energy in time to save us from catastrophic climate change. In general, what did you find?
My major finding is that the technology for transitioning towards a global, low-carbon, sustainable economy is ready. This includes technically piloted and demonstrated wind, water, and sunlight systems, which are also fast becoming economically affordable. Now, there is a preponderance of studies, models, and scenarios that points to this possibility. And I've mentioned the global nature of a 100% renewable energy future, but a number of studies have also emerged as of late showing the specifics and how every country on Earth can actually progress in their transitions using only the renewable energy technologies that we already have.
And your scenario for doing what we need is called the Rapid Mitigation Agreement. Please tell us about that.
The agreement sets the stage for achieving deep national cuts in emissions with a window for auditing national achievements. The agreement makes very clear that we want to achieve a global target of close to zero emissions from the energy sector within 30 years, but not later than 2035 for richer emission states, which are historically at their highest. For developing states, the target will be within 40 years, but not later than 2050. So this particularly ensures that by mid-century, 2050, global emissions have peaked and will be declining really, really steeply. The agreement is different from what we currently have, Paris Agreement, in that the proposed agreement would address free riding by bluntly assigning targets and timetables in a top-down scheme. Now, that approach may appear pathetic to many, especially in the context of the bottom-up approach that generally led to the Paris Agreement. But the proposal is to be appreciated in the context of a wartime approach, where during the war, belligerent nations have actually spent up to 70% of their GDP on military.
what are we going to do about rogue countries? Well, we could almost count the United States in that because they signed up for the Paris Climate Agreement and now threaten to withdraw from it, and they're pushing more fossil fuel production. How will we handle that after the Rapid Mitigation Agreement is signed?
So what makes the proposed Rapid Mitigation Agreement different in that? Here, I called for an audit mechanism that would reduce the possibility that some nations might break off it and to lay sanctions for countries that fail to meet the targets. To illustrate this, I called on that historical moment in Casablanca in January 1943, during which the Second World War actually peaked.
And what was that agreement? I'm sorry, I don't know my history on that.
So the 1943 Casablanca Agreement between Allied nations included a text by which Allied leaders who that time, January 1943, met at Casablanca in then France, Morocco, and they decided that the only way to ensure post-war peace was to actually adopt a policy of non-conditional surrender. So this policy was made to avoid a situation that followed the First World War, where large segments of German society supported the position that Germany was not defeated militarily, hence the German rearmament and consequently the violation of the Treaty of Versailles. What we don't want to occur is another Treaty of Versailles-like infraction happening in the period of rapid mitigation, during which the rapid climate mitigation is in effect. And using the Casablanca Agreement as a model, the Rapid Mitigation Agreement has to do at least four key things. The first is to establish mandatory emission cuts to ensure a 100% renewable energy regime before 2050. Second is to establish an assessed contributions approach to a multilateral fund to support the transition of developing countries. Third is to establish a global monitoring mechanism that would periodically review mitigation targets. And fourth, to establish penalties for non-adherence or secession from the agreement through trade sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, reduced foreign aid, and censure at international forums.
Now, Lawrence Delina, let's talk about motivation. Science is pretty clear there will be widespread and devastating climate events if we continue to load up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. But beyond that sort of gradual building storm, if you will, there are also some black swan events. What are some of those less likely but powerful climate signals we might see?
You are very right. The science is very clear on the devastating and large-scale impacts of global climate change. Now, black swans actually refer to those tail events in your bell-shaped probability distribution curves, if you remember your Statistics 101. In normal bell curves, these tail events signify unlikely outcomes. Outcomes from climate impacts, however, have high likelihood, meaning you can have fatter tails. This means that we can have, in an unchecked climate change, more of gray swans or even the more familiar white swans. Now, these events are highly catastrophic. And according to one analysis, they include the following. The melting of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, a dieback of the Amazon rainforest, and more persistent El Nino regimes. Now, how likely these events are to happen? The scientists estimate that at least one of these tipping points or tipping events will be triggered in a temperature increase of up to 2 degrees Celsius. That's very close. And more than one of these events can actually occur in a temperature increase of 4 degrees Celsius. Now, a simpler reading would say that these events are not totally remote.
I know that Russia experienced severe fires and heat waves in 2010, and they still are fossil pushers, really. And we had tens of thousands die in the French heat wave, and much of Pakistan was flooded. Hurricane Sandy cost billions. And yet we're still not motivated, apparently. What will it take and what could happen that would send the world a big enough signal?
In the book, I discussed that climate-related events, however catastrophic they are, those black swans, which are actually white swans, are not guarantees that governments will act aggressively against climate change. So that is one of the many aspects where the analogy between wartime mobilization and climate mobilization diverges and becomes a little bit problematic. Whereas wartime mobilization was triggered by aggressive threats on territories such as the attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila, which has been under American control, which eventually triggered the United States mobilization for war, the stimuli for a rapid mitigation program are very hard to predict. I would like to believe that signals would come from a variety of sources. This would include extreme climate events for sure, but you can also discount the role of a stronger climate action movement.
Well, I know that the World War II economy depended on an enormous expansion of public debt, and even before the climate challenge, we already have stupendous debt at almost every level of government and even personally. Is there really any room for more debt without destroying completely the value of money? Is debt part of the program that you envision?
You are right. The Second World War ushered in an unprecedented volume of public debt. Contrary to concerns over stupendous public debt, however, it is the growth and acceleration of private debt that we should be worried about. This is because private debt drives asset price inflation or bubbles, which always burst, and in effect, they cause economic destruction and financial disruption. Private debt insurance, not public borrowing per se, should be controlled. This doesn't mean, however, that we continue on borrowing till kingdom come. Societies must be emancipated from the constraints of debt, including those made by the governments. Yes, I have described in the book, public borrowing to finance the sustainable energy transition has to come as a complement to taxation. Taxing carbon polluters remain a key policy I am advancing in the book, and I have also discussed several proposals for new forms of taxation, including a progressive tax that can be levied on consumption. But tax and borrowing are but two ways to fund the transition or the rapid mitigation project. There's still the need to source money beyond these traditional mechanisms. I have listed a number of approaches, ways, and means in the book, but that include taking out fossil fuel subsidies and revisiting national budget items apportioned for defense and wars and realigning them to the purposes of the transition.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and scholar, Dr. Lawrence Delina. We're talking about using World War II mobilization as a model to combat climate change. One of the hallmarks of World War II, Lawrence, I think, in the United States and Canada, even more in Britain and Germany, was rationing of consumer goods. Came right down to things like sugar and butter, which were needed to feed the troops. I still think we need to ration consumer goods. Everything we buy contains embedded carbon to produce and transport it and all that. And we need to buy a heck of a lot less, I think, to get emissions down. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Rationing was a hallmark of wartime mobilization, as it is a way to solicit everyone's contribution to the war effort. I haven't discussed rationing of consumer books in the book, as my focus was on the industrial mobilization part. But rationing is key in climate mitigation, especially in envisaging strategies that revisit the way we consume things, which has obvious effects on our emission profiles. Curtailing excessive consumption is essential if we are to effectively address the climate challenge. And you're right, carbon is embedded in all things we do, all things we make, and things we eat. The solutions to anthropogenic global climate change comprise urgent, traumatic, large-scale, and transformative changes in areas beyond how we obtain and consume energy. And a comprehensive approach to effective mitigation ideally involves strategies to decelerate total global economic activity and consumption. In that regard, there is much to learn from wartime rationing.
Your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, doesn't avoid the hardest questions, and a big one is the whole problem of government control and trust in government. And as we've just seen in the American elections, trust in government seems to be at an all-time low, just when we need it most to save the climate. How can we overcome that?
The hardest aspect of climate mobilization is non-technical. It's the social and the political. And as I've mentioned, the technology is ready, waiting to be deployed in the large scale. And it takes staged, structured, planned, and coordinated response to do just that. It is in that area of coordination and marshalling the necessary resources that the governments have historically been effective. These lapses in the book and use them regardless to provide us lessons with how governments can possibly mobilize their agencies effectively in the context of rapid climate mitigation. During the war, we saw how the likes of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, providing the much-needed political will and leadership to prosecute wartime efforts and to mobilize industries for wartime. How we wish we could have the same traits from our leaders today. But things are very different nowadays. Trust in government, as you have mentioned, is indeed at an all-time low. We saw that in the American elections of November 2016. We constantly saw it finding almost all over the world. citizens are losing trust in their governments, more so in their leaders. I don't really have a prescription in how to overcome that challenge in governance. But I take my optimism from a number of initiatives from the local, from the grassroots. The rapid mitigation project, regardless of whether it is a top-down approach, will still need strong citizen engagement. The histories of many successful and violent movements provide us mirrors on how this could be done. That actually is the second strand of my research and one which I am currently developing as a new project here at the Rachel Carson Center. This is a bit about this this follow-up project. I try to look at strategies on strengthening the climate action movement from lessons of many histories, including the People Power Revolution in my country, the Philippines, the struggle for independence in India, and the modern American civil rights movements, among others. What I'm trying to say here is that these moments of histories can actually provide us new strategies for driving rapid climate mitigation. And that can be through climate activism, traditionally construed as people, for example, shouting on the streets and doing civil disobedience. And on the other hand, it can also be through prefigurative means, such as people organizing themselves into cooperatives to build solar or wind farms.
I contacted you precisely because so many people have put forward the wartime model as a way to fight climate change, and you ended the title with a question mark. What do you think in the end? Were you able to develop a model that could work in the real world?
What I learned is that, yes, there are opportunities for learning from the industrial mobilization for Second World War and possibly apply those lessons in the context of rapid mobilization for climate change. I have shown that strategies can be developed in terms of mobilizing finance, labor, and administrative resources to quickly deploy renewable energy technologies. This is the model that I think can work in the real world. However, there are caveats to the analogy. We have to be actually cautious if we are to adopt similar wartime strategies in addressing climate change. We don't want our government to become a coercive one, although we are seeing a lot of governments today turning into one. In that regard, I propose in the book, and this is part of the model, the creation of an equally strong institution to ensure that what governments do are in line with the objectives of rapid mitigation, and that is to quickly replace fossil fuel systems with renewable ones using energy generated from wind, water, and solar, and nothing else. Now, there is no guarantee that governments would actually do that. I raise in the book the likelihood that governments would actually elect to do large-scale risk NGO engineering to possibly build walls to keep away climate refugees and others. Adaptation, of course, is important, but that misses the opportunity to address the challenge at its root causes, and that is to rapidly zero out emissions.
As we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yes, the wartime model for rapid climate mitigation is strong in one sense. At the same time, it has limitations. I accept that there will be critiques and questions about the technical, social, or political assumptions I made in the book. Many of the strategies for rapid climate mitigation I discussed there are unattractive, controversial alternatives, especially if viewed in a predominantly market-oriented frame of mind. Many of the strategies I presented in the book are highly idealized and utopian, even for progressives. And for liberals, they can be considered highly intrusive. But I would like to invite everyone listening to us to consider a very short thought experiment. When climate impacts hit us in a scale, scope, and intensity beyond our expectations, beyond our current imaginations, during such events, what do you think will government do? Most likely than not, they will expand their power and most possibly intrude into our private lives. Now, we have a choice. Shall we wait for that situation to pan out and have confused governments responding to forced migrations, conflicts, famines, or we use the contingency strategies this book is advancing, proceed and activate an organized government to mobilize resources for rapid mitigation within a bounded portfolio of plans and activities with oversight built into it. Now, I'm not really a fan of both, but the latter strikes me as the lesser of the two evils.
I completely understand. We've been speaking with Lawrence Delina. Educated in the Philippines, New Zealand, and Australia, Lawrence has been a visiting scholar at the Harvard Kennedy School and an advisor for the United Nations. He studies the longer-range future at Boston University. He's currently at LMU Munich. Lawrence Delina's new book, published by Routledge, is Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. I'll put links for you to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.